Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight and answers from people who make decisions. And you will, I hope, leave knowing more than when you arrived. Coming up on the program. Brazil and South Africa move quickly to stabilize meat supply as disease outbreaks push food prices higher. Vehicle finance demand climbs with new deals up 12% across the market. Digital banks facing real pressure as outdated systems drive up operating costs, and why your year-end bonus feels smaller and why your budget may be to blame. It's Friday, the 12th of December. South Africa's protein security is under fresh pressure as new foot and mouth disease cases drive culling and push meat prices higher. Against this backdrop, the Brazilian Animal Protein Association is in the country this week for a high-level round of conversations with government, importers and veterinary officials on stabilizing meat supply, improving disease control and aligning South Africa more closely with global regionalization standards. I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Ricardo Santin, Chief Executive Officer of the Brazilian Association of Animal Protein. Ricardo, a very warm welcome to you. How, firstly, can Brazil help South Africa stabilize protein supply as we face these new outbreaks of FMD and also rising meat prices?
Hi, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and it's a pleasure to be here in South Africa talking with our partners regarding the protein supply. Brazil is a major exporter of chicken meat in the world, major exporter of beef meat in the world, and also the third largest exporter of pork meat in the world. Brazil has a very strong partnership with the South African processors companies. We supply 95% of the MDM, mechanically deboned meat, to South African companies that made the Polonaise, the Viennas, and the sausages. And we are here to try to get some regionalization recognition of Brazilian production, trying to prevent a ban as we face it, and even influenza recently surpassed by Brazilian authorities. And also, we show it in this seminar, the experience Brazil has on control of foot and mouth disease and declaration of Brazil that is free of foot and mouth disease without vaccination in a huge country that has seven times more territory than the size of the South Africa, that is already a ninth largest territory in Africa. And then this is the purpose of this seminar, and we are here for to be partner of South Africa on these issues.
What then, Ricardo, are you hoping that the seminar is going to achieve for both countries as we face the difficulties that I've already outlined?
Yes, we intend with this seminar to show the importance of the OWA guidelines, the World Animal Health Organization, that has guidelines that forecast some situations as the regionalization for when you have some disease. It works for avian influenza. It works for foot and mouth disease, it works for PIRS, for African swine fever, because it's a principle that you can segregate the state or the county that has some disease in one country that is exported, and you can keep the trade flowing and the exporting going on from the other parts of the country that is exported. For instance, Brazil, that has a huge territory. If you have an outbreak of avian influenza, as you had on the state of Rio Grande do Sul this year in May, only one case. It was already ended. But if you close only Rio Grande do Sul, you will keep the trade flowing to South Africa from the rest of Brazil. And you don't have the hike of price that we face here on polonies and sausages because Brazil was out of the market.
Explain to me how difficult it is to implement a policy then of regionalization and how it is sustained and monitored.
The difficulty is just on the side of the South African authorities, because there is no difficulty if you look to the Brazil. If you look to the OAH, World Health Organization, World Health Animal Organization guidelines, it's easy. You can have the conditions. And South Africa already has these regionalization commitments with the United States and the European Union. It's just a question of to change the health certificate database for to export to South Africa. And then when you change this document, it's already put in force. And then there is no difficulty. It's just a question of to South African authorities to get the information about Brazil, to see that Brazil has condition to fulfill what they are saying to South Africa. And then is the thing that we understand that is necessary, that South African authorities just check the information from Brazil and put it in force, because it's a question for to prevent inflation of the food in South Africa. Brazil has the conditions to show that it can segregate the production from one state on one county only that has one case of avian influenza, for instance, but it depends on the South African authorities now.
Ricardo, you argue that regionalization protects food security. I understand that, but it's also about protecting Brazil's export volumes, is it not?
Yes, it protects Brazil volumes, but for instance, to South Africa, what do we export? MDM, it's a mechanically deboned meat, is a kind of raw material that exports for to produce polonaise and sausages. Brazil is the largest exporter. We export to more than 150 countries in the world. When we have this case in Brazil, 122 countries didn't close Brazil. Only 28 closed, including South Africa. What we send the volumes that we export to South Africa, for instance, to another countries, to another destinations, to destinations inside Brazil, for instance, to produce ration and other things, and to produce sausages in Brazil. And then we could manage this. But here in South Africa, the price of MDM raised, skyrocketed from 13 rands to 15, to 20, to 25, to 29, to 30, 35 rands per kilo. And then this is not good. Brazil can face this because we can redirect, we can send the products to another destination. But for instance, in a place that is 95% of the imports of MDM came from one country, and I don't have the regionalization, I will make an inflation for the people. This is the point. And this is what we are asking to South Africa, is just make the regionalization with Brazil as the same as you have with the United States and you have with the European Union, because Brazil has the same condition of these countries.
And just finally, Ricardo, are you confident that South African authorities are open to the call that you're making about regionalization?
I'm not confident regarding to the judgment, because it depends on the South Africa. But I'm very keen that I saw a very good will of the South African authorities to check about these informations. They are looking for us. We have a director on the seminar representing the Minister of Agriculture of South Africa. And then he told, we will make a working group and we'll check the informations. And I hope that the South African authorities recognize the regionalization, not only for avian influenza, also for foot and mouth disease, also for African swine fever. But also we have, and I repeat, Brazil has a commitment. We signed an MOU, a memorandum of understanding of intention between our Vice Minister of Agriculture and the Minister of Agriculture of South Africa regarding a cooperation and a transference of technology and technology about the control of disease, especially in foot and mouth disease without vaccination.
Right. I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Ricardo Santin, Chief Executive Officer, the Brazilian Association of Animal Protein. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Vehicle finance, I read, is making a strong comeback in South Africa after interest rate hikes forced thousands of middle-class consumers out of the vehicle asset finance market. The data now shows a sharp rebound, with new VAF business up 12% year-on-year, car sales at decade highs, and longer repayment terms easing affordability. Let me just give you some numbers before I introduce you to the guest. October seeing nearly 56,000 new vehicles sold, the best monthly performance in more than a decade. Used car sales are strong, driven by more affordable Chinese imports and lower monthly installments, as lenders now stretch repayment periods to 90 months and beyond. Therein, of course, lies a risk as well. Joining me is Andrew Fulton, director at the research company 8020. He's been with us on the program before and is always a font of very interesting information. Andrew, welcome to you. Why has vehicle finance then rebounded so quickly after such a sharp contraction 2023 and last year?
Yeah, thanks for having us on the show, Jeremy. I mean, well, if you think coming out of COVID, how bad things were, you know, there were very significant headwinds sort of by 2023, 2024. We had the lowest ever prime rate after the pandemic, but then 10 consecutive repo rate increases, which really priced a lot of people out of the market, including following on from that as well. You had record high inflation. We had stagnant wages. And that seems to have, all of those sort of forces have taken a bit of a turn. You know, we've had a number of repo rate drops. Salaries are starting to catch up. Inflation is under control. People are getting back into the vehicle market. And as you said, you know, decade highs for vehicle sales. And how do you buy them? You buy them with vehicle asset finance. So there's been a follow-on effect with vehicle asset finance.
And that's welcome news, but there is a huge risk here. Auto sales, as you say, booming, but income has not grown. Are we simply stretching repayment terms then to make cars more affordable? And there's this jump in the 90-month loan. Do you think it improves affordability, or ultimately is it just going to delay the financial strain and we'll be bitten at the end of this?
Yeah, I mean, it'll do both. I mean, one thing you think about affordability, it's a month-on-month issue, so it's a cash flow issue. So certainly extending your car loan out by an additional 10, 20 months is going to make your cash flow position on a regular basis better. But yes, it does sort of in some ways kick the can further down the road and extend that payment longer. It also does make more money for the companies that are giving the loans, because they've got you indebted for a longer period of time. But yeah, what we noticed was there were, at the beginning of 2024, about 7% of vehicle asset finance loans had terms of 90 months. That's doubled since 2024 to 16%. So it's certainly a significant move in the market with people extending those loans out.
And Andrew Fulton, how broad-based is this recovery? Is it driven by just a few consumer segments? And I notice you use terms like middle-class workers and heavy hitters.
We do. And what we can see is it's concentrated completely in the middle-class workers and the heavy hitters. About 88% of all that is happening with those two segments of ours, which, once again, it is a rebound, because we had, you know, in the previous 4 years, about 150,000 people had dropped out of vehicle asset finance in the middle class. So it is nice to see them getting back into it. I mean, that is one of the kind of bastions of being middle class, is having a car, having kids in school and aspiring to be university and owning your house. So those are good features for the country.
Just give us a differentiation between middle class workers and heavy hitters.
So what we do, our segmentation is 8 segments, 46 subsegments, and then 1,500 microsegments. And we define the middle class as between about getting from 15,000 Rand a month up to, let's say, about 40. I mean, it's a movable band. And then our heavy hitters are sort of 40,000 plus. But they are the most diverse group, because some of those heavy hitters are making, you know, a million Rand a month as well. So it's kind of everyone, the 3% north of 40,000 personal income a month.
How big a role, according to your research, have Chinese brands played in this turnaround? I think if I read correctly, that market share is still rising, is it not?
It is still rising. I mean, it's been, I mean, every time I go to Joburg, I see another billboard for a car manufacturer I've never heard of. It's incredible. But they're certainly, they've gone in on affordability and you know, good features for the price. About half of the 14 Chinese car brands who are now active in South Africa came into the market in the past 2 years. I mean, that's an amazing statistic there. And while there are no Chinese brands amongst the top 5 bestsellers, you know, it's the usual sort of Suzuki's, Volkswagen, Toyota, you know, Chinese brands have surged from about 3% of the total market in 2020 to about 13% now. So, yes, certainly growing fast and will continue to grow.
And latch on to that used car sale. sales, which are surging alongside new car sales, a sign of confidence, or do we read a little bit of continued financial stress into that observation?
Yeah, it could be a couple things. I mean, one thing I do feel, I mean, certainly I feel in my sort of 25 years in business, the brand of owning a car and driving a fancy car was very significant 20 years ago. And, you know, the younger generations are maybe less interested, so they're happy to get an older car. But certainly it does have something to say about affordability. You know, you can get a good secondhand car. I mean, there's, once again, you know, most of the billboards in Joburg, if they're not advertising Chinese cars, they're advertising We Buy Cars or one of the other secondhand car dealers. And if you look at We Buy Cars, really impressive results up to 30 September 2025, 13% growth in revenue. So yeah, they're doing well, as the secondhand car market.
Let's focus on the downside quickly. We've had 12 months of sales growth, as I mentioned. What's the risk here? What's the concern? What could derail this?
So I mean, I think the risk is always that people start getting over indebted beyond their means. You know, like, I think what we noticed certainly with the recession before COVID and then COVID was a lot of South Africans in the middle class were one paycheck away from being back down into like mass market. Because a lot of their lifestyle was funded through credit. And if you lose your job, you can't make credit payments. You know, a car is something that they can repossess much more quickly and easily than a house. So there is that danger that people could kind of think these good times are going to last and overextend themselves.
And finally, let me not be a harbinger of gloom as we approach the Christmas period, but if we see another economic shock next year, consumers would obviously be more exposed because they're taking on longer debt. So it's a question of buyer beware.
It is, absolutely. I mean, so far it looks so good. You know, South Africa was taken off the grey list. You know, we've got a drop in petrol prices. There's a number of good signs that things are going well, but we'll have to wait and see how Black Friday and festive season sales go to really get a guide on where the economy's headed for 2026.
Look forward to talking to you again. That's Andrew Fulton, director at the research company 8020.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South African banks these days look slicker and more digital than ever, but beneath the apps and interfaces, many, I understand, are still running on decades-old foundations. And this is a real paradox facing the industry. Modern customer experiences driven by legacy systems that consume, and this is a worrying figure, more than 80% of IT budgets just to maintain. What's the result? Well, I guess slower innovation, rising costs, and transformation that is often cosmetic rather than structural. I want to try and make some sense of all of this, and let's not get too technical. I'm in conversation now with Ishmael Mpabanga, who is country head at Intellect Design Arena South Africa. And maybe let him explain why banks must move from digital first to AI first architecture and how redesigning the core can unlock agility, speed, and cost savings. So, Ishmael, this is an interesting one, and it's a subject I haven't tackled before. You call this a digital paradox, so shiny apps, as I said, on top of old systems. How serious is that gap in South Africa right now?
Jeremy, thank you for having me. It's an honor to actually speak to you. The reality is that many African banks look incredibly digital on the surface. Great apps, smooth interfaces, but the real bottlenecks sit much deeper in the core, right? You mentioned an 80% a number. It is a big number, right? Now, across the industry, we see banks spending heavily on their front-end channels, but they're still running on 20 to 30-year-old architecture. Now, so you end up with what I call a digital illusion, right? So banks don't have a digital problem per se. They have an architectural problem. And the experience looks modern, but the machinery underneath is still legacy. So we need to tackle this, and they need to tackle it slowly, be innovative. They need to also look at reducing some of their costs, and it's making it harder for them to keep up with their customer expectations.
Banks, I would argue, would suggest that they are already in that phase of transformation. How then do you distinguish real architectural change from just cosmetic upgrade?
Look, this is one of the most underappreciated issues, right? Many tier one and tier two banks are currently 70 to 80% of their IT budget is spent on just keeping the lights on. Now, maintaining these legacy cores, custom integrations, aging infrastructure, it leaves maybe 20 to 30% of real change that can be achieved. So even if the CIO wants to drive bold innovation, the financial oxygen is being consumed by the legacy. And when we talk about real architectural change, in my view, it's an AI-first architecture that needs to be adopted. It's not about sprinkling AI on top of old systems, but it's about baking intelligence into the way the bank is designed. Mm. Now, practically, what does that mean? It means moving away from big monolithic core to more composable building blocks. Right now, I know we said we weren't going to talk too technical, but I try and keep it as layman as possible. Now, when I talk about composable building blocks, it's more about microservices for things like payments, limits, pricing, onboarding, risk, and so on. Now, each building block is independent. And by virtue of doing this, they're orchestrated through a common intelligence layer. Now, if banks look at this the way that we look at it at Intellect, now we have an EMAC.AI architecture, which is the most modern architecture you can have within the industry, right? And banks can modernize their core safely. They can start breaking into more composable building blocks without looking at their overall big monolithic cores. And this allows them to innovate without disrupting operations.
How do you convince executives, though, Ishmael, to stop patching and start real redesigning when I would imagine patching feels a lot softer in the short term?
It's an interesting conversation. I have multiple conversations with many leaders in the C-suite across many banks and within the financial services industry itself. I always say the real transformation starts in the boardroom, not in the server room. So if the conversation at the top is purely about what we can automate this year, we're on the wrong track, right? The better question is, what should we redesign so that automation actually matters? Now, that's where first principles thinking comes into play, something that we pride ourselves at Intellect Design. You strip banking back to the fundamentals, the transaction, the event, the journey, and the ask. And we're designing this from scratch today with AI and cloud available. That's how we should start looking at it. Now, once leadership shifts to that mindset, you naturally move from project-based patching to thinking, looking at the platform-based, the architecture, and that's when you genuinely solve the digital paradox. It's a conversation that we're grappling with every day.
So let's bring this to the door of the consumer, if we can. Are there business outcomes that are most visible when banks adopt this AI-first system approach? Is it faster decision-making? Is it lower costs? Is it new products? Mm. Maybe all three, I don't know.
Look, yes, in many ways, African banks have some of the most pragmatic adopters of this thinking. They've started to look at it differently now, and they're starting to look at it with the customer in mind, right? Yes, we've built new apps. We've got a lovely front end. There's ease of use. But banks are still really under pressure on cost-to-income ratios. They operate in highly competitive markets. In South Africa, you know, the top four, top five banks are all vying for the same market share. They can't afford 10-year transformation journeys, right? And the appetite in terms of what is safe, how do we look at incremental modernization, what does that mean, what are some of these tangible outcomes, are things like cutting time to market, right? And we've cut time to market to 6 to 9 months, from 6 to 9 months to as little as 6 to 8 weeks. Now, this is real change, and this is great for the consumer. We've reduced operational expenditure in specific domains like payments or trade. And again, this has a downstream effect to the consumer on how they look at gaining more from the bank. And accelerating credit decisioning, that has a big impact on the consumer, putting money in their pocket and they're able to do some stuff. So by virtue of doing this, I think the banks are starting to look at it differently. And my job and our job at Intellect is to try and help them get there.
And if they do nothing, where's the risk? Will they fall behind fintechs? Will they lose customers? Or is it a regulatory issue?
Look, I think banks, by sheer nature of their construct, they have a responsibility to their consumers. They have a responsibility to the industry, right? Would they fall back? Would they lose market share to fintechs? I think it's more of a partnership, them losing market share. We've seen a lot of partnerships. I mean, Ikoko with Nedbank. Mm. We've just heard that Capitec have also just bought a big payments capability. So it's for them, they've realized, as in the banks, shall I say, have realized that they need to start partnering with fintechs in order to stay relevant and in order to be able to innovate at speed. So I think in the future, we are going to start seeing more innovation. We'll start to see the banks realize that they need to look at their architectural frameworks differently and start to position themselves much strongly in the market. And of course, Revolut is about to come into our market. They just received their banking license. So that's going to completely shake up the industry. What do we need to do? What do the banks need to do? I think the proof will come out in a few months once we start looking at some of these projects and what they mean in the long term.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what develops. Ishmael Mpabanga, thank you very much indeed. Country head at Intellect Design Arena South Africa. Interesting conversation. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's bonus season, but many South Africans say their 13th check just isn't stretching the way it used to. What am I talking about? Well, rising living costs, tax bracket creep, and year-end expenses all eating into take-home pay, and that is leaving households feeling squeezed in spite of those lucky enough to get a salary increase. Consult by Momentum's Chief Financial Officer Boipelo Ndimande says the bonus isn't the problem, it's all about the budget. Boipelo, a very warm welcome to you. You go on to say that budgets are broken. Isn't that just another way of saying that we are so overwhelmed by costs that we are almost out of control as South Africans these days?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for having me. You're correct. So what I'm saying when I say budgets are broken is that we are overwhelmed by costs and we're not looking into each and every line item, that we don't feel where our money is going. We don't feel where our money is being spent and how we're spending it. So, for instance, if we look at small things like lifestyle creep, we take on subscriptions, smaller subscriptions, we upgrade our lifestyle, but we don't realize that it's those small things that eat into each and every cent. But given also that we haven't received that additional income in our pockets.
So how do you deal with lifestyle creep then?
I would say, Jeremy, you would need to do a budget. You need to sit down and look at what comes in versus what comes out. There's a lot of places where we can make savings, and we are not looking at that. So we need to sit maybe with a financial advisor and look at each and every line item. Consider whether it's necessary in your spend, and if it's not, then maybe you shouldn't be spending on it. So just look at each and every line item in your budget and interrogate it and be deliberate about it.
What do you say to households, though, who feel the advice to relook at the budget just ignores the reality, Boipelo, that there's literally nothing left to cut?
So, oh my goodness, Jamie, that is a very good question. There are some lifestyle changes that you can make in your budget and cut something from there. If you do feel that you are really under pressure, then you can speak to a financial advisor, maybe contact your credit provider and see how you can work around your debt and also how you can work around what is in your income and use it to the best of your ability.
You also recommend, if one is lucky enough to get a bonus, you recommend splitting it when it lands in your bank account. What does that mean, and how does that work when December debit orders sometimes exceed disposable income?
That is correct. I would say you would need to split your budget. You would need to think about what is essential, what you need to be spending on. So maybe it's the back to school items that you need to be spending on. And then think about your debit, your debt. Also think about how you can decrease your debt, because when you decrease your debt, you give yourself that relief monthly. But I'm also saying to you, Jeremy, that we've worked so hard for our bonuses, so it doesn't mean you don't get to enjoy it. After you've done all the responsible stuff, then it's time to just, you know, have some guilt-free spend. But you would need to be very wise in how you split that bonus.
It's also a difficult one. It's all very well to tell consumers to plan better, to talk to their financial advisor. But if you look at year-end increases, Boipelo, like medical aid, insurance, school fees, all of these are non-negotiable and rising above inflation. Again, it's a real conundrum.
It is a real conundrum. What I like to do is when I do my budget in the beginning of the year, I take those increases into account. So by the time you do get your bonus and you do get your yearly, your annual increase, you've already taken into account. So you see what you're most likely going to end up with before you get that increase. So just start taking these kind of costs into account, because they are non-negotiable. So you have to take them into account.
Do you think, and you said, and it's good advice to talk to your financial advisor, because at least on paper, they should know a lot more than we do. But sometimes they maybe offer generic solutions instead of confronting the deeper affordability crisis of an individual. What sort of conversation do you need to have with that financial advisor as we draw towards the end of this year?
So at Consult, we believe with on advice with context. We get to understand you as an individual and understand where you're trying to go in your life and what is at your disposal. And then we then start giving advice based on that. So we give advice based on the individual and not generic advice. We need to understand everything that relates to you. So you need to have open and honest conversations with your financial advisor.
If a bonus these days is worth less than, say, 2018, 2019, is there anything that needs to change, do you think, at policy level before budgeting advice can genuinely make a difference?
I would say there is a lot that needs to change, Jeremy, and that's a really good question. I would say there is a lot that needs to change. We really need to look at the policies, the inflation, and also just how we remunerate employees.
So moving forward then, the best advice is to look at the conversation with the financial advisor and take into account all those extraneous items like a tax bracket creep and information that is already in the domain, which perhaps you've ignored. It's going to be a very difficult conversation, isn't it?
It is going to be a very difficult conversation. And like I said, it really needs to be an honest conversation. You need to be honest with yourself and honest with your financial advisor. If you make those cuts, you make those changes, it really opens up a lot of more opportunities for you and relief for you monthly.
Well, some good advice there, Boipelo Ndumande. Thank you very much indeed. Consult by Momentum's Chief Financial Officer. I do appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's our program for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.